technology, and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is actually a pretty interesting set of topics, security-related topics that you should know about, that have occurred over the last 2 weeks. One of those is that the Verizon 2017 data breach report has been published, and I've been going through that and compiling some notes for a whole other dedicated show on that, so look forward to that as the next show. And in that, I'm going to talk about, I'm really going to try and summarize a couple hundred pages of breach report information for you and condense it down to the point where you know what are the things that you can do to mitigate the risks that were a lot of these people that got breached that affected them, so that, again, we can learn from the mistakes of others. But for today's show, let's start off with a single USB flash drive nearly ransomwared an entire school. And as always, I have links to these articles published in the page associated with this podcast. So feel free to look that up. And the detail on this is that a professor had utilized a flash drive on his home computer and had, had some infected files there, and then had literally uploaded that into his Google Docs or his Google Drive store. And he then goes to school and downloads through Google Drive. So not just a USB flash drive, but through Google Drive itself, had downloaded those files, and those files were ransomwared, they were malicious, and that then what happened was, because his computer that he was using at that school was on the same subnet with really the majority of the other systems on the campus, then what ended up happening was that malicious code was able to propagate out. Now, fortunately, the IT staff responded pretty quickly to that, and they ended up catching it before it got out of hand. So kudos to them for having an effective rapid response plan in place. However, some of the lessons that we can learn from this is people really need to be aware of the fact that Google and Dropbox, and frankly, any of these free services, do not provide advanced persistent threat scanning, malware, virus, just the bad stuff in general. When we can use the term malware to describe virus, ransomware, and really anything that is malicious junk, there is no scanning engine for that that is included in the free Google anything, nor is there any of that anti-malware scanning included in the free Dropbox. Now, if you pay for Dropbox for Business, which is pretty darn pricey, and if you pay for G Suite, and then you also then have to buy a separate package, and I've talked about this before, the preferred package is Trend Micro's Cloud App Security. Now, there are other products on the market. However, the Cloud App Security product is really extremely effective. And I use this for all kinds of clientele, certainly use it myself. And it's not the only product that I use, obviously. However, it is a product that has been very well proven to effectively stop these threats before they ever get to your endpoint. So, we've heard about how malware can be transmitted over USB flash drives, and of course there is still no remediation and no risk mitigation strategy for bad USB, that's literally what it's called, other than to just not use USB flash drives. And so, clearly this has been the approach that I've recommended for some time now, at least the last 2 years. Just don't use USB flash drives. And if you have to use a USB flash drive, well, it better be your USB flash drive that only you are using, and you only ever plug it into your systems. You are not using that device to transfer files to unsecured systems or systems that you don't have full total control over. So if you say, okay, well, I'm not using USB flash drives, well, we then have to look at this example of this professor who transferred these files that got infected. They got infected on his home computer. He put them into Google Drive. He then goes to school. He downloads them from Google Drive. And because Google Drive inherently has no built-in security scanning capabilities, because it's free, I mean, why should it be secure if it's free? I mean, it just, you know, if you want something to be free, if you want something to be secure, you're probably going to have to pay something for it. So he then downloads that and ends up getting things infected as a result of it. So what the school should actually be doing is paying for, you know, they can have G Suite for free, sure, because they're a school. However, they should be paying for something like Trend Micro Cloud App Security and then plugging that into their G Suite and, you know, and having those security protections in place. Now, it's not astronomically expensive, nor is it free. So, you know, you really have to ask yourself, well, what is the expense profile of a breach, or what is the expense profile of having all of the computer systems or even a significant chunk of the computer systems ransomware or just messed up in general? And look at what the cost of that would be, and then compare that to the cost of paying for a security product on an annual basis. So it's really important that you understand that having a host-based security product by itself will not, and I'm going to stress again, it will not mitigate the risk associated with these things. What we have seen time and time and time again is that ransomware and many of the latest malware variants are just so darned sophisticated and so darned fast that if you don't kill them before they get to your computer, then your computer will be damaged. So you have to be scanning these things at the cloud layer when this content is literally out there in whatever the cloud storage is. That's where you have to scan it. Scanning it on your computer with the endpoint protection is too late. I'm not saying the endpoint protection doesn't have some validity. It obviously does. I mean, I wouldn't go without it. However, by itself, you cannot expect it to actually protect against these types of risks. Okay. So if you want to check that out in more detail, I've got the link to it that's going to get posted here. Now, the next topic is about printer hacking. This has really become a hot topic lately because a gray hat hacker decided to do a full internet analysis and look at how many printers were completely wide open to the internet. You know, so what we're literally talking about here is somebody has either taken a printer as a completely unprotected device and hooked it straight up to an internet connection with no firewall between. So that's one, you know, that's one disastrous configuration. The other disastrous configuration is where somebody has actually gone to the effort of creating a hole in their network security layer by port forwarding certain print ports from the internet, and I mean from any external all internet, to their printer. That's also catastrophic fail in terms of configuring. So this guy did an analysis where he found all of these printers were just wide open to the internet. And so he sent them a print job to bring the issue to the attention of the people that owned these printers. And a lot of the people who received these print jobs went to Twitter and they took photographs of their various stuff that they got that were printouts, and they posted it to Twitter. Well, there were then journalists who picked up on this and started collating this and then were writing articles about it, which I've posted several of the articles. And something that is astronomically fascinating in this analysis is how many of the compromised printers were point-of-sale system printers. So I'm literally talking about things like check register or, you know, point-of-sale register printers. Now, these are the things you put your credit card through. You know, and all this information. I mean, think about it this way. One of the ways that the bad guys have been collecting data for a very long time is by hacking printers. Printers are inherently weak. You have to go through quite a lot of effort to secure them. And then there's only just so much security you can actually put on a printer. At that point in time, you have to create network layers of security around that printer to prevent it from being hacked, as well as to prevent it from being a source of data exfiltration on your network. And I got to tell you that that is way beyond the skill and way beyond the effort level that 99% of humanity ever goes to. And I'm talking, when I say humanity there, let me caveat it that I'm not talking about people that don't have computers. I'm talking about people that actually have the responsibility to manage that equipment. All right. So when you consider that, we're really talking about the absolute vast majority of people who have the responsibility to manage either the printer or the network or the firewall do not go to the effort to create those network layer security rules around those printers. And also, the printers themselves are not managed in such a way that they are made more secure, such as changing the password on the printer, not allowing weird protocols like Bonjour and UPnP, and then also restricting things like SNMP traffic. Okay, so there's a lot more to it than that. However, a lot of people just get a printer and they just put it in and they're like, oh, it works, yay! And they don't consider the security ramifications of that printer. Now, if that printer becomes compromised, it can quite easily be used to send a copy of literally everything that is, you know, scanned, faxed, or printed on that device to the bad guys across the internet. So you have to ask, well, how secure is my printer? So there is literally a wiki page. I'm not talking Wikipedia. There is a wiki page on hackingprinters.net. I have this linked that tells you tons of stuff about hacking printers. And the reason that this is out there is so that you could self-assess and, effectively penetration test your own printers if you were an IT professional. And I've also linked the Pret printer hacking tool, which is great for penetration testing your own printers as well. But for the rest of you out there, especially if you're in the retail space, especially if you're a business owner of a place that has a point of sale system, if you take credit cards, even if your point of sale system is as simple as what you find in a lot of small medical offices where it's a machine that takes card swipes, you know, credit card swipes or debit cards or things like that, you need to be very concerned about whether or not that device has been adequately secured from the internet. And I would have to say that unless you've actually had an IT security professional configure that, it is probably not secured from the internet. And the evidence exposed by this gray hat hacker really demonstrates that, because the majority of the printers that were quite obviously just straight on the internet or unprotected at the network layer were credit card, debit card printers for point of sale systems. And just shocking. I mean, really just shocking. So please do check out those articles, as they are, at the very least, insanely entertaining, especially the photos that all these people took of their point of sale printers being hacked. It was a big hoot. So there has been a phone scam that has been going on. And this phone scam is where you get a call, and that call is from a phone number you don't know, you answer it, and then the person says, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you, you know, something like that. And then you say, yes, I can hear you. Well, what's then happening is they are recording your voice in this whole yes business. And then they use this to scam you further, where they claim that your yes statement was acceptance to be charged for services. And then, of course, you're charged for those services. So the amount of phone-based scams that are going on, I think, is really just outrageous. For when I talk to people, what they're telling me is they're getting probably 5 phone calls a day. And I mean, this is virtually everybody is getting phone calls every single day from phone numbers they don't know. And these scammers, of course, never leave a voicemail. They don't leave a voicemail because they don't really want you to call them back, because it's not a legitimate call. So this, you know, I think the only risk mitigation approach that you can take is kind of twofold with regards to this. Number one is to not answer the phone if it's a phone number that you don't know. And I suppose you could say, well, I have to answer my phone because I'm, you know, running a business or something like that. Well, I'm going to offer you a slightly different approach that you can decide if it's a good fit for you. But certainly if you do pick up that phone and somebody that you don't know is sitting there and saying things like, can you hear me? Can you hear me? And you know that they're trying to entice you to say yes, then just hang up the phone, right? Just hang up the phone. So the other technique that I have for you, though, that I have seen really come into a great amount of value in the last couple of years, and more people are finding a lot of value in it, which is that it's this idea of firewalling your phone. I know that's just a weird concept for most people, but we are at the point where these scammers and criminals have effectively declared war on us. And what can we then do in order to prevent them from being able to victimize us? Well, we are firewalling things at the network layer. We are doing security filtration at the email layer, at the cloud layer, and, you know, at the host-based layer, right? We're doing all of these other things. But what about the phone vector? You know, what about phone as a vector of being able to get at you? So the way that you can deal with this is you might consider getting a Google Voice number. And when you get a Google Voice number, what it then becomes is the phone number that you provide to people. And this actually works as a legitimate replacement for a cell phone that can receive emails, voicemails, calls, and text messages. So this is great. And the way that you, now, of course, you have to configure it correctly. So one of the ways that you can configure it is to put in there your contact list of people who should legitimately be able to call you without any sort of pretext. And when I say pretext, it's kind of like an announcement mechanism. So for unknown callers, they would call and they would be prompted to have their voice recorded where it's please announce yourself sort of a thing. And then they say who they are that's calling, and then that then makes the call go through. If they do not announce themselves, then the call never actually goes through to you. So it doesn't even ring. This is pretty darn cool. And so, you know, all these bad guys, a lot of them are using these systems where there is no human being. It is a pre-recorded call baloney. And they're just robo-dialing a bunch of numbers and then attempting to victimize. And even in the circumstances that there is a human being, then that human is typically still sitting behind some sort of a dialer system. So they have a phone dialer system. They're not dialing the numbers themselves. And then when there is actually an answer, that's when that call is connected to them. And by the way, those are the same exact phone systems that are typically used by any sort of a call center that is making outbound calls. So I think that it's rather useful to have this phone firewalling technique in place if you think you are technologically savvy enough to be able to manage that. Now, if you don't feel like you're savvy enough to manage that, then what you might do is just get a second phone number and send that out. In fact, there is a company called Abine, A-B-I-N-E, and they have a great product called Delete Me, which I do strongly suggest that you look into. And they then also have another great product called Blur. So that's B-L-U-R. And with Blur, you can subscribe and they will give you disposable email addresses and disposable phone numbers and disposable credit card numbers. It does, you know, there is a fee associated with it. But if what you're trying to do is to prevent your true, real back-end information from getting compromised, well, then you just have to take the approach of never giving that out. And I've read in a lot of places that anyone that you have an account with that is a financial services place, who then goes and reports that information to any sort of a credit reporting bureau, this is some of the worst places that you can do, that you can provide your information to. So you were talking literally about banks, credit card companies, the utility company, your phone provider, because what they do is then take that PII and they say, oh, well, we have a credit account, or we have an account with this person or this party, and we're now going to report that information to the credit reporting bureaus. Yeah. And next thing you know, there's that information, it's out there. And I think banks are actually the worst for this. And I don't mean to like beat on like your local regional banks, because they're not really the prime perpetrators of it. The prime perpetrators I've seen of this are really the big national banks. They seem to just take your information and spread it around. And so then the problem becomes, now that information is in more places, therefore it's more exposed. Therefore, it's more highly likely that the bad guys are going to be able to pick up on that information in some breach or another, or just data leakage. So the rule of thumb, I think, has to be that if you are really trying to prevent your phone number and certainly other PII from getting out, then you just have to not get it out. You just don't give it out at all. And the services that Abine has with regards to Blur and Delete Me can actually help you quite a lot with that. So the final topic for today's show is how a university was attacked by their own Internet of Things devices. And they were attacked basically because they didn't have good network design. So I'm always interested in telling you about what you can do in order to mitigate these risks, because so much of the time we find where the mitigation is not that hard. I mean, you don't have to be a giant organization to do it. In fact, a lot of these mitigations can be done in a home environment. So what happened was that they had a lot of Internet of Things devices, such as vending machines, smart light bulbs, and other types of things like that. And, you know, these Internet of Things devices, we've known for a long time, are not really that secure. I mean, the manufacturers who are designing the code for these items are not putting time in, they're just not putting the time into doing the security work associated with this. They're trying to get their product to market very fast. So they're mostly concerned about user functionality or user experience. They're not concerned about securing or hardening these devices. And so when you have to utilize things that you perceive are not secure by themselves, then what you have to do is to create network layer rules around that to prevent your stuff from getting breached or compromised because of these insecure devices that, from a business purpose, you need to actually have on your environment. And so the way that you do this really isn't hard. You create another subnet. Now, it could be a VLAN. It could be a physical subnet. It depends on how you do it. But ultimately, this subnet has to exist in the perimeter security appliance. So it has to exist in the security appliance so that the security appliance can apply security rules to the traffic going to and leaving from that subnet. So if you're putting VLANs where the routing is occurring in the switch and your switches are not security appliances, well, then you're not meeting the requirement here. So the two main things that happened to this university that caused them to have major problems was that they did not segment these devices to a segment all unto themselves. And then they did not create these security rules around that network traffic. And finally, they also were not using a DNS proxy. And so ultimately, and I've actually seen this in Kenosha, I have seen this where devices will be infected, and they will be infected with something that is utilizing DNS as a mechanism to do a denial of service attack against whatever the upstream equipment is in order to try to break it and to do a buffer overflow so that it can do a privilege escalation attack, etc. So the way that you mitigate this is really straightforward. It's segment your traffic and then use a DNS proxy. But you have to actually have equipment that is sized to be able to handle the load of proxying that traffic. So this is why I have said for years that correctly sizing security appliances is an art form. You can't just strictly talk to the manufacturer for sizing your device, and you can't just call up a sales rep at some company who is not the security architect themselves. You're not going to get an answer that helps you procure the right piece of equipment that has the horsepower to be able to have that horsepower to handle the proxying that you need to protect your stuff. So DNS proxies require quite a lot of horsepower, and a lot of people's devices are definitely not strong enough to handle that functionality. However, DNS proxies are absolutely irrefutably necessary in today's environment, even if the only thing that you're trying to do with the DNS proxy is to prevent DNS from being the data exfiltration mechanism on your network. And I actually did a whole previous podcast on this topic of using DNS proxies to prevent data exfiltration and how you can practically implement this in your own environment, really even at home or at any size of an organization. So it's really quite attainable for any size organization. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show today, and I always look forward to your feedback. You can either use the contact form on qualityplusconsulting.com or send me an email.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Thank you.